Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to hour number two of the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live from the fabulously fluoridated capital of Auckland, New Zealand, the island chained nation in the sunny slave South Pacific. It's not only Fukushima, it's also Fukushima irradiated, which is good for the economy because everybody got a part-time job as an incandescent light bulb. My very special guest is Neil Slade, writing a book about tickling your amygdala and the Book of Wands and all sorts of other stuff. And I had a question to ask you, Neil. Have you ever been, like, you know, in your room tickling your amygdala and your mum walked in and caught you?
That's brilliant. No, I'm one of the fortunate few who's never had that embarrassment. Although,
all right.
This does remind me, once we went to Las Vegas with my parents, and my sister was with us. My sister and I shared a room, and mom and dad were in the other room. And I did something that made my sister very angry. So she immediately called my parents in the next room. She says, you know, Neil's got Playboy magazines under his mattress in his room. So although they never caught me tickling my amygdala, they probably figured I did from time to time.
Yeah. It was kind of like voting for Reagan, you know. Heaps of people did it, but everybody denied it.
Well, let's see. Bruce Willis is not in denial. He's made very public statements about his regular tickling of his amygdala.
How does he do?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he's been very proud of the fact. I'm sure there have been a few celebrities out there. I used to always say, you know, Ronald Reagan acts like he never has to go to the bathroom, and we all know he does. So
yeah.
One thing to say something in public and reality. Reality and your public persona are often two very different things, aren't they?
Indeed. Speaking of public persona, you have a website too, don't you, now?
I have several websites, but the main one is brainradar.com. And if you go to brainradar.com, then from there you can get to all my other kind of other websites that are all related to that. But Brain Radar, I knew that everybody could spell that. I knew a lot of people couldn't spell Neil. It's like, how do you spell Neil? Is that N-E-A-L? N-I-E-L?
Is it with a K? You know?
Yeah, exactly. That's right. So I just said, hey, brainradar.com takes you to my main website, and there's you can go all over the place. That's the main one. So thanks for the plug. Appreciate that.
Well, that's all good, man. This show's kind of like a bathtub. Doesn't work very well without one.
Yes, I noticed that in your email. So anyway, so you know, the video is kind of cool because if we talk about wands and tickling amygdala, like I've got all kinds of weird wands in this house, so it'll be good for demonstrating, or at least showing what some of those things are. If people, though, do, you know, if we get into the Book of Wands stuff, people should go to bookofwands.com. And that's not Juan as in a fellow who lives in Mexico. That's W-A-N-D-S as in Harry Potter types of wands. Although, please do not get me confused with the imaginative fiction of Harry Potter. The wands I speak of are real unusual tools, most of which you have sitting around you. You know, for example, here's a real wand. It's a ruler. Just looks like a plain ruler, does it not? Now, the thing that makes a wand, a real wand, an unusual tool, is most people, when they see something like a ruler or a spoon is a good wand. Here's a wand that I haven't really played around with too much. But these are all ordinary things that you have laying around the house, right? And we usually assign a ordinary task for such devices, such as a spoon. So if you say to people, how do you use a spoon? They say, well, you stick it in your drink and you stir the... There's me using an unusual tool in a very unusual, very conformist, very ordinary way. But what makes a wand is not so much what it is, but what your brain does with that thing. And your brain changes this spoon into an unusual tool or wand. And so then you use that device in a unconventional manner. And that's what will launch you into an alternative reality or a parallel universe, as it were. So we can talk about that more about later. But the reason I brought that up was people should go to bookofwands.com when we start talking about wands, because then they can see pictures of a lot of different wands, and including the first one, which is a decorative broom. If you go to Book of Wands, there's a little toolbar, and it says Photos. And go to where it says Photos on the main page. And that will open up a bunch of pictures where you can click from one to another, and that will then show you what some of these wands are, and then I can describe what they do and what they've done around this house and that kind of thing. So anyway, so just kind of a preemptive go to Book of Wands or go to brainradar.com.
Okay. Well, let's talk about this then, as in terms of wands and things like that, because something that comes to mind is me and my girlfriend were watching this travel show once, and this girl was taking a trip down the Nile on a fisherman's boat, and she asked the fisherman, "So how did they build those pyramids there? You know, did they float the stones down the rivers on boats like this?" And he's like, "No, that's crazy. These boats would sink like nothing." They use wands. They would tap the stones, and then they would levitate, and then they would push them along. and she's sitting there like with her eyes raised, going, "What?" And apparently, this you know, there's actually a lot of evidence that they were kind of like, are they technology or are they magic, or is technology magic?
Yeah, I don't know if we'll ever know unless you can go back in time, which is one thing you can do with wands. But last year, I was interested in the pyramids for one reason or another. I was reading a book, and there was a fellow, a scientist, archaeologist, and there have been a lot of theories about how they moved the stones in Egypt. And he had actually shown the physical way in which they could do that. And it had to do, I can't remember now exactly how he described it. Probably during our conversation, it'll come back to me. But there was they had found a physical way that they could move the stones with a small number of people. Previously, they had speculated that it would take tens of thousands or, you know, an ungodly number of humans to move these stones. And he showed I know what it was. Now it's coming back to me. It was a portion of a circle. It was not quite a semicircle. They would construct not a raft, but some sort of bed that they would put the stone on. And by putting it in between these two things, a very small number of people, like 10 people, could move one of these blocks that might weigh 10 tons. They could actually roll it up an incline with a small number of people. It was something that they found they couldn't do with sleds. They couldn't do with a number of other inventions that people had speculated, but by cutting a circle into like three pieces and then putting one portion of that wooden circle on one side of the slab and then the other one, they could actually roll the slab up as much as a 10 degree incline. So there is a physical way that they've discovered that they could do it, and that they have subsequently tested with real people moving 10 ton stones and found that they could do that. But all that aside, that's not to say that they didn't use wands. That's just one guy's explanation. He could be completely wrong.
Did he find any of these third circle artifacts that he claims could be used?
No, they didn't find it, because back then they would have made them out of wood. So in that period of time, the wood would have disintegrated. Now it's all coming back to me. What he did, this is how he came up with the idea and with the solution. At the base of the Sphinx, I believe, there are some stone hieroglyphs that are carved into the base of a wall at either the base of the pyramid or I believe it's at the base of the Sphinx. And there were some symbols there. And nobody knew for the longest time what the symbols were. So one day he's like, you know, like the proverbial taking a cat nap. He's sleeping and the light bulb goes off. And he realized that the symbol looked like one of these stone, well, it's not a slab, it's a cube. It's a big square block of granite, except it had the semicircle on either side of it. And he said, that's how they did it. They made the semicircle out of wood, strapped it to the cube, and by doing that, it made it possible to roll it. You know, I'm looking for a cube around.
Well, no, here's the deal. This is exactly the same methodology as walking a fridge. You can't pick up the fridge, you can't drag the fridge, but you can simply roll it and rotate it and waltz it around. You know, yes. A much, much heavier thing because you're using its own weight as a balancer on just one little corner, sort of thing. Similar principle, yeah.
That's right. So what they did is they took a cube and by putting a semicircle on the top and bottom, it then turned it into this shape. Well, you can't really see it, but it's a circular thing here. And then exactly, you could roll it up. So that's what your comment about the wands and the pyramids reminded me of. So very often, you know, we're looking, we think something's impossible until it dawns on us that, oh, if we just put a semicircular slab of wood on this 10-ton cube, five of us can roll it up the hill. It's a matter of your brain looking at something from a little different angle. And that's exactly, that's the secret of wands. That's what wands are. It's applying your frontal lobes, the most advanced part of your brain, and this ability to look at things from a different way than the conventional way in finding a solution. And if you can apply your brain in that way to just simple objects that you have around the house, a computer keyboard, a pen, that can be something that can change history, a pen. But we typically look at a pen as being, well, it's just a, you know, we can write something with it. But it's a far more powerful tool than that.
Well, there's an old saying that the pen is mightier than the sword, and I believe in the modern age the camera is mightier than the pen. And I think maybe in a very short period of time there'll be another bit of technology that's even more powerful than the camera, because these are simply tools of documentation. And I think that if the truth is there and people know it's the truth and can see it, it's more powerful than any other form of lie or BS or anything. If it's incontrovertible, really, you can change things by allowing those things into the public eye.
I'd agree with you wholeheartedly. I think the influence of YouTube and internet video is going to be the big game changer. We've seen that. Yeah, a camera is a wand, and people have used it as a wand. They've used their cell phones as very powerful tools for change that we couldn't conceive of 10 years ago. The whole Arab Spring and uprising, for a large degree, that was due to the use of people using their cell phones and organizing, you know, groups of people. And that was using something that had been around for decades, a cell phone, but now using their brain in conjunction with the cell phone and communicating, history's been changed. And I think we're just seeing the beginning of how cameras as wands will change our reality and life on planet Earth.
Well, hold on a second. So basically, when you say wand, you mean any physical device that does something that's value can be more than its simple ability. Its value is actually that which we can do with it, but cannot even think that it could do by itself.
Yeah, exactly. It is using a very common tool in a very unconventional manner. And by doing that, you actually transform that tool into a completely new device. Sometimes you'll be successful with it, and other times you won't. But that's a matter of your brain understanding what that that tool is capable of. So wands are, you know, Julia, would you get me one of my squiggly rosewood wand that's on the organ? Typically, when people think of wands, they think of what is by category called a baton. So yeah, this is right. So here is this is a baton wand right here. This is the kind of thing that you might have seen in Harry Potter, right? You got a handle. This is a pretty interesting one. It's an ebony handle. It's a rosewood with a very nice kind of squiggle to it. Now these really, in lore, people would go, you would think you'd go zoom and zap. You would zap something. But in another context, a conductor of a musical orchestra would lead the orchestra in such a manner, right? And so this kind of has a dual personality, as it were. You know, in music school, Julia's pointing her sword. Here, bring your sword, Julia. Come on in. You come on in. This is Julia, come on here. Come in, come on. She's camera shy. Here's a sword. You were talking about a pen is mightier than the sword. And this is what my wife is Chinese. We'll get her on camera here. And so this is a sword, right? It's not a sharp sword. Typically, a sword would be used for killing people. But this is a Tai Chi sword. So this is something that is, in a more unconventional manner, a sword is used for exercise or it's used for meditation. And in Tai Chi, it's part of... Holy shit, yeah!
Here's the sword.
That's right. Here's the sword to quiet the dog. Ooh, end of Chloe. Anyway, so...
Good thing it's not sharp. Hey, Neil, we lost your audio for a second there.
Oh, yeah, you got it back?
Yeah, you're back.
Okay, all right. I think it was a network glitch. Maybe it was the sword. I was cutting the connection. So there we have of the sword doing something completely unpredictable.
Well, guess what? We're now going to be cut off by the break instead of the sword. We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen, with Neil Slate. His websites are brainradar.com and bookofwands.com. Back in just a few minutes, ladies and gentlemen. Don't you go anywhere. Welcome back, everybody, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. Everybody else out there like boogieing? I like boogieing. It's fun. And it gets you the exercise and the joyous nature and things that you do, just like with the music. My very special guest is Neil Slade, and he's going to give us a hand-guided tour of the Book of Wands.
The Book of Wands, yes. So people would go to the Book of Wands website right now, the first thing they'll see is they'll see a picture of this here book. It says Secret of the Dormant Brain Lab. And there's yours truly with the secret. There's the secret. See that little ball of light? That's the secret of the Dormant Brain Lab. And there's a picture of a cabin. And you get a good picture on the Book of Wands website. And that cabin belonged to my brain teacher. His name in real life was T.D.A. Lingo, but in the Book of Wands, I call him D.A.T. Stingo. Everyone's got a pseudonym in the book. And I had I was his personal assistant for about 11 years at this brain laboratory, which was, who is it? Jung. Jung had a house in the wilderness that he lived in. Did he not?
Who?
Carl Jung.
I've never heard that name.
Oh, Carl Jung was a contemporary of Sigmund Freud. And so Carl Jung did a lot of exploration in the field of psychoanalysis and dreams and symbology. And he was, like Freud, he wanted to understand the human mind and the human brain. Freud, everyone knows what, you know, Freud based his methodology on analysis of dreams. Jung did that, but he kind of took it to the next level and tried to come up with explanations of the superconscious and the collective unconscious, things that Freud never really got into. And Jung lived in isolation for, I believe, a good part of his life. Who's the fellow in Massachusetts? The literary figure, his name is escaping me right now. Well, there are a few people from time to time who lived in the wilderness, but this fellow that I studied with in the book D8, who am I called D.A.T. Stingo, he lived in this very cabin at 10,000 feet elevation, 40 miles west of Denver, Colorado, in the wilderness with no running water, no electricity, no heat except for burning logs in his wood stove. And that's a real picture of the place that this fellow lived in. And he lived there for 35 years and he studied the brain. And so I was his assistant for 11 years and I used to go up to the brain lab, every weekend during the summer and also throughout the year. And he's the guy who sort of got me steered in the direction of wands and so on and so forth. So that's what that main picture is. But on the Book of Wands, if you go right below that, there's a website menu and there's a one that says photos. Do you see that? See the link? It says click on the link that says photos and that opens a new page. And then if you scroll down the page, you'll see a picture of this very weird-looking broom hanging on the wall. Do you see that?
Oh, yeah.
That's this very broom right here. And that is a real, and I kid you not, a real flying broom. And
would you care to give us a demonstration?
Yeah, well, not in the Harry Potter sense. I can't ride on this broom, but it flies all by itself. And it's done so.
It somewhere.
No. You see it hanging on that hook in the picture?
Yeah.
That's a very, very secure hanger. And when that's wedged in there, you've got to really push that up to get it off the wall. It's a very secure rubber hook. There's nothing that can get that broom off that hook except by taking both arms and yanking it with a good amount of muscle power, and then you can get it. You have to lift it up and then out to get it off that hook. So here's the story of this flying broom. This must have been in 2007 when I first started working on, I decided I would start writing about wands and the things that I had learned from D.A.T. Stingo and the Brain Lab. And it took me 3 years to write down all the lessons that I learned and all my experiences. And while I was doing it, the last Harry Potter book came out. And it was, as you may or may not remember, it was a pretty big thing back then. And here we have a very well-known bookstore called The Tattered Cover, about five blocks from my house. And it's the biggest bookstore in between Chicago and San Francisco. They had 3,000 people show up for the premiere or the release of this Harry Potter book. And people came in their costumes and it was a big kind of showy thing.
Nerd convention.
Yeah, exactly. That's right. All these crazy people. And right across the street from the Tattered Cover is East High School, and there's a woodworking teacher there. So he decided for this event, he would make some wands like this, and he would make some decorative brooms like the one that's hanging on the wall and the one that I just showed you. So they were hanging from the ceiling of the tattered cover, and I thought, you know what? I need a little bit of inspiration to help me get my book of wands written. So I ended up buying three batons from him and three decorative brooms. And the brooms all look different. They're all full size, but they're not really meant to sweep the floor. They were meant to be more decorative. So I put them on my wall, and I just kind of looked at them from time to time as I'm working on my book of wands to, you know, inspire me, to get me going. But something very strange began to happen. The first time it happened, my wife and I were in our bedroom, and it was 1 o'clock in the morning, and we were both sound asleep, and all of a sudden we hear, bang! We hear this loud explosion, and we both instantly bolted up, and I thought somebody had kicked the front door into the house, and a burglar had broken in. And I didn't hear any footsteps, so I slowly got out of bed, and I started tiptoeing around the house, and I didn't see anyone in the house. And I went to the kitchen, and we had a cutting board table, and it had fallen down onto its side in the middle of the kitchen. And I thought, it was a folding table. It was a folding cutting board table. So I thought, well, maybe I didn't put it up against the wall quite right. Although it seemed rather unlikely, you know, it's a big, heavy thing, but it had fallen down into the middle of the kitchen. And I thought, that's what made the noise. So I put it up and I went back to bed. And I thought that was the end of it. It wasn't. The next night, it must have been 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, same thing. Bang! This loud noise. I bolted up in bed. And I looked over at my wife, Julia, and I thought, Julia, are you banging the headboard in your sleep or something? What's going on? And she was sound asleep. So I thought, I better get up and see what it was. So I went, first thing I did is I went into the kitchen, and the table was fine. It was fine. And I thought, oh, okay, that wasn't it. I wonder what it could have been. So I walked into the living room, and to my surprise, there was that broom in that picture. This big broom, and it was lying in, not next to the wall, but it was in the middle of the living room floor. And I'm thinking, how could that happen? How could this thing, and it, I mean, it is wedged in there good. How did that broom get from the hook into the middle of the living room floor? And so the next morning, I got up and I explained to Julie, I said, our broom flew off the wall. And she says, oh, come on. I says, no, I found it in the middle of the living room wall. I have no idea how it got there. We've got a couple of dogs, but at the time, they were 13, 12 years old. They had no interest in the broom. They couldn't knock it off the wall even if they had tried. We had no explanation. First the table in the kitchen, then the broom in the wall. So I thought, that's really strange. All right, so next night, nothing. It was peaceful, ordinary night's sleep. But the night after that, Julia couldn't sleep for some reason. So she got out of bed, and she went into the living room and fell asleep on the couch. And at about 4 o'clock in the morning, again, she hears this loud noise, bang! And she didn't know what it was. And then when it was light enough that she could see what was in the living room, she looked in the middle of the living room floor, and there was the broom again. It had flown off a second time, this time while she was in the room. And we thought about it, and we thought, well, this broom is flying off the wall. What could be the reason for it? And the only thing I could come up with is that we had a woman who had committed suicide in our house years before I had moved into the apartment. And I had only found out about this years later when my neighbor told me the story. My landlord never told me. And my friend suggested that the woman was still in the house, and now that Julia was just visiting me at the time. She was living in Columbia. She came in. She was visiting me. He said, the woman, it's obvious, the woman is jealous of Julia, and she's having a temper tantrum. And this is how she's showing her protest, by knocking the table over in the kitchen, and now she's making the broom fly off the wall. And she had done it twice. So immediately, Julia made peace with the ghost, and she had talked to a friend who knew about Native American culture. She says, listen, I'm going back to Missouri next week. I don't mean any harm. I'm your friend, and please don't throw the broom around anymore. So it didn't happen again until about 9 months later. And I had had a old college friend visit me. And this was my girlfriend from my college days. And I hadn't seen her for a while. And she came over and she spent an hour at the apartment. She went home. That night, the broom flew off the wall again. The woman apparently was jealous and was causing this broom to fly.
So this is like some kind of supernatural cock block.
Absolutely. And that wasn't the last time. It happened again while I was in the room. I thought I'd knocked my laptop computer off the coffee table. Then I realized the broom had flown off the wall again a fourth time. And then it happened a fifth time while Julia was just on the opposite side of the wall in the office. So indeed, this is a broom that wants to keep flying. Hasn't happened in about a year, but since we've had it, it's happened once or twice a year. So what is this telling us? What it's telling us is that we, in fact, the universe may not be playing by the rules of physics that we all think are the end-all, be-all of reality. The broom is demonstrating to us that we live in a multidimensional reality where things can happen that we don't have a physical explanation to, that we may be surrounded by beings such as this woman who committed Harry Carey in my apartment one day. She's still with us. And we in fact live in a multidimensional reality. And our experience in this house using wands and seeing things like the flying broom demonstrates this to us over and over again, that there's not such a simple explanation as to the way that things work in this world. And we should be open. We should be open-minded to all of these possibilities. That's the real lesson in that.
My contention is that there's been two worlds for a long time, the physical and the metaphysical. One isn't I believe that the physical world is dominant, but that doesn't mean the metaphysical doesn't exist, and that doesn't mean that it can't come on and change things in the physical world, or at least that's what I've kind of seen and heard from a number of different stories from all around the world, your story that you're just telling us now, not least of all. The other part of it is, where exactly do you draw the line, and is there even a line that can be drawn, or is it so blurry that you cannot discount one or the other ever?
All right. Well, it sounds like ready for a break, and I'll talk about that when we come back.
Indeed we will, at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for listening. We have one more segment in it with Neil Slade. His websites are bookofwands.com and brainradar.com. Back in just a few minutes, folks.
There's something evolving. Whatever may come, The world keeps revolving. They say the next big thing is here, that the revolution's near. But to me it seems quite clear that it's all just a little bit of history repeating.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the final segment here of the Vinnie Eastwood Show. My very special guest, the man who knows how to tickle his amygdala, Neil Slade from brainradar.com and, of course, bookofwands.com. What is it that you'd like to round off the old interview here with today?
Oh, gosh. Well, I had another story that I wanted to share with you, which was pretty interesting, because you said, what is, you know, is anything possible?
What we were talking about was, where is the line drawn between the physical and the metaphysical, or is there even a line? Is it so blurry that they can't be separated from one another? They are one and the same.
I think pretty much what happens is our own expectations and our own brain is what is our limiter. You know, you have a limiter. And when you use audio software, it only allows it keeps your volume level within a certain range. And our brain does that with reality. When people take a drug like LSD or mushrooms, what it does is it removes those limiters. So then we see colors that we normally don't see. We hear things that we normally don't see. So the drug can remove those limiters in our own brain. But what a lot of people don't realize is that you can also remove those perceptual limiters by using your brain naturally, by changing your thought process, and indeed by learning how to tickle your amygdala, by brain self-control. So you can start to remove those barriers and those limits if you can change the way that you think. And I don't mean just wishful thinking. I mean understanding fundamental principles and the rudiments of how the human brain operates. Once you've got those brain basics under your belt a little bit, if you understand on a scientific level how the brain works, then you can start to remove those restrictions. So my wife, Julia, really, Julia, come on in. Now you can poke your face in so people can have a look at you. Julia has this natural ability to go beyond all those. No, you got to stand right there. Here's Julia Liu, the extraordinary painter. Wave. Anyway, so this is whom we're talking about here.
Yeah.
I'm a very left brain kind of person, and Julia's a pretty right brain, and she's a painter. She started out very left brain. She got a degree her PhD in science. That wasn't enough because she didn't want to teach in at the university. So she became a lawyer. Bye, Julia. So she went and got a law degree, became a lawyer. And then she said, nah, I don't want to do this either. I'm going to be a painter. So then she started painting full time. So now she's a painter. But anyway, she has this natural ability to go beyond these boundaries. And when she first moved to Colorado, she moved into a house that was two blocks away. And I could stand on my porch and I could see her house from my porch and vice versa. So one night, it's about 9 o'clock, she says, Neil, I want to come on over, but it's dark. Will you come over and walk me over to your house? Because I'm a little bit afraid. I says, Julia, just grab a stick or a cane. And I had loaned her this cane, and this is one of those sword canes, right? And I said, just bring your sword cane and I'll meet you halfway.
Like out of Blind Fury with Rutger Hauer.
Yeah. So I was thinking of the cane in a more traditional sense of providing protection. But at that time, I was not fully aware of the potential of this particular wand, which we learned about that evening. So she took it with her, and I locked up the door, and I locked my front door, and then I started walking to her house. And I started walking down the middle of the street looking for Julia. And I got all the way to her house, and I didn't see her. And so I go to her door, and I knock on her door, and I see all the lights are out on her house. I said, where did she go? How did she get to my house? And so I started walking back, and I thought, oh, man, hope she didn't get in somebody's car. You know, did she get a lift, or did she take another way? So I'm walking home, and as I'm walking home, finally, I'm about half a block from my house, and I see her standing on my porch. And I get to her, and I said, Julia, how did you get to my house? And she said, I walked down the middle of the street. And I said, I walked down the middle of the street. Now, on our street, we've got these very bright sodium vapor lamps. So if you're walking down the street, you're not going to be missed. There's no way that you're going to not see another person walking down the middle of the street. But sure enough, that's exactly what happened. Then I thought, well, wait a minute, maybe you got here while I was downstairs or something and you came in. And she said, no, when I got here, the front door was locked. So I clearly had locked the door behind me, left. And somehow we had passed each other in the middle of the street and not seen each other. And Julia, I believe, had made herself invisible. And the reason I say that is because she had spoken to Ginger? And Ginger, who was her Native American friend, had told her, says, well, you know what? If you don't want to be seen, you have to think that you are invisible. And in fact, it had happened to her on another occasion where she had been in an automobile accident. It was just impossible. And she was thinking at the time that she didn't want to be seen. What was that circumstance? She's explaining it to me. Yeah. Well, anyway, she, at that point in time, she had, again, not wanted to be seen driving. And someone had run into her, impossibly hadn't seen her car. And then on this occasion, she didn't want to be seen. And sure enough, she was invisible to my eyes. And I'm not blind. And so, again, where is that line of what is possible and what is not possible? And, you know, she had tapped into something where on two occasions where she didn't want to be seen, she indeed was rendered invisible.
I could use a skill like that, you know, ambushing politicians, you know, all of a sudden here he is.
Yeah. Well, we're continually surrounded here by our own, I think, exploration. And I think both Julia and I have kind of come to the realization that nothing is impossible. And when you kind of give up that addiction to saying, well, this is possible, these are the limitations of what is possible in this lifetime, we've given that notion up completely. And as we've given that up, we find that these impossible things just happen on a kind of regular basis around here. And it makes life very interesting. And it makes us able to do things that previously we thought not possible.
Well, it's the understanding of the nature of reality and that we live in a probabilistic reality. You know, things are, and in a probabilistic reality, anything is possible. In a cannibalistic reality, anyone is edible.
Very well said. Very well said. Well, yes, cannibalistic reality seems to be what most of our politicians and corporate CEOs, they seem to live in that reality, don't they?
Well, you know, what's the difference between cannibalism is when you eat somebody else? What's it called when you eat yourself?
I don't know. Do you have an answer for that?
I don't know. I honestly don't. But whoever comes up with that word, I think that's really a great summation for how humanity is currently living. We're eating ourselves.
Yeah, yeah. We do. We definitely have to make some changes on this planet. And I think the best place really to start is, you know, inside your own cranium. If one can say to oneself that anything is possible, then you move closer to that reality where we can find solutions to you know, cannibalism and global cannibalism and that kind of thing. I think it's very important, you know, to remove those limitations. And I think life becomes a lot more fun when you do that as well. So
yeah. I've noticed that so many people have difficulty having fun in life, and that's because the first thing that they think about when somebody suggests to them having a bit more fun, the first thing they think about are the reasons why they can't, why they shouldn't, why it's not possible. The first thing you should be thinking about is, how can we do that? How can it be possible? Is that something I want to do? And if you've got those that thought process in your mind, you'll find that the possibilities open up. But if your thought process is to close them off, surprise, surprise, they shut the door to you.
Well, I hope I've helped people understand that with the books that I've written and with the books that I've done. You know, tickle your amygdala. You know, it all starts with, you know, right in here. Change that, and the rest of the world changes.
All right, Neil Slade, ladies and gentlemen, again to reiterate, his websites are brainradar.com and bookofwands.com. I advise you to check it out, and if you're really interested in reading, get the books as well. Neil, thank you so much for your time, and nice, we'll see you again.
Till next time.